Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Jenny Knoll is a Penn State professor of human development and family studies. She's also the director of Penn State's Network on Child Protection and Well-Being, which was created in the wake of the Sandusky scandal. An internationally recognized researcher on child maltreatment, her work focuses on the long-term consequences of childhood sexual abuse. We'll talk with her about the findings of a unique decades-long study of women who were abused as children, about translating those findings into policy and practice, and about what we can all do to protect children. Jenny Knoll, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Patty. It's great to be here.
If there is a silver lining as a result of the Sandusky scandal, it's that it has focused national attention on the problem of child sexual abuse. Penn State has made a commitment to become national leaders in this field. What exactly does that mean?
Right. This is a real commitment, Patty. This is a faculty-initiated initiative, and it comes out of the president's office, to really turn the dial on child abuse and neglect research and treatment and education. In my field, which is, as you know, pretty small, nothing like this has ever happened. And when
nothing like a university saying, we're going to take this on.
We're going to tackle this. This is a real problem that hasn't had the attention that it needs. It's a bigger problem than people think, and it deserves a large investment. And that's a big silver lining of this. And I'm just very excited to be here to sort of charge this. And it's why I came to do this and why we're trying to attract other researchers to do the same thing.
Well, in fact, you came from Cincinnati Children's Hospital,
right,
where you were involved in a landmark study that I want to talk with you about in just a moment. But what can you do here at Penn State that you couldn't do in that hospital setting?
Well, it was just me and a few other researchers there. But here, there is a long-standing tradition of experts in family systems and health psychology and behavioral integration with health issues. The faculty that are already here are world-renowned. So to come here and integrate what I do and what other researchers in child maltreatment do with that expertise, that's going to be how the fields are going to change.
Now, the Network on Child Protection and Well-Being, which you head up, will be built with faculty over 3 years.
Right.
It will be a 12-member team, and as you said, working collaboratively with folks who are in human development and family studies and other places throughout the university. Why is integration and collaboration so important? And I ask that because it's not just in the work you're doing, but when you hear about children's advocacy centers, everyone's talking collaboration. Like, you cannot wrestle this problem to the ground without collaboration.
Right. Well, and multidisciplinary is really the key, too, because what we're understanding about this kind of childhood adversity is it doesn't affect just one part of the person either. There's a family system around this. There is a community around this. There are law enforcement issues around this. There are health issues that are far-reaching, consequences that are not just mental health, but physical health. And to be able to bring a multidisciplinary collaborative effort to this, that's what's going to turn the dial. New treatments, new prevention efforts, new way to reach these families, new ways to help communities understand the problem and work on prevention together. That's really the innovative part of all this, and that's what a cluster hire does. And Penn State has done this before in other areas, and this was just a really good idea, and it shows the commitment from the president's office on down.
One of the things President Erickson said is the child maltreatment field is extremely small, as you mentioned, and within the field, research into child sexual abuse is even smaller, which makes me wonder, what brought you into this field in the first place?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. Part of it had to do with my background in methodology and studying lives in general. So I got to learn from some of the experts in methodology and developmental psychology. And through that, I started to learn about the best ways to follow people through their lives. And
but why child abuse
why
victims?
Child abuse? Well, you know, sometimes, you know, you choose your science and sometimes your science chooses you. And I really feel like the latter happened to me. I met Penny Trickett, who's my longtime collaborator, and Frank Putnam, my longtime collaborator on the landmark study. And I got really inspired by how they were listening to pediatricians, they were listening to practitioners about how these kids are just different. And when we started the study, we didn't think we would follow them this long, but I knew that some good methodologies could be injected into this idea, and then we could really learn something powerful.
You mentioned Penelope Trickett, who started this landmark study 25 years ago.
Right.
NIH has just given you funding to continue it for another 5 years, which is allowing you to track some 250 women, some of whom were victimized as two-year-olds.
Right.
They entered this study at age 10 or around that age, and
right.
you've been following them
right.
all these years,
right.
you yourself for the last 20 years. One of the most remarkable things about the study is that 85 to 95% of the people who started in the study are still
right.
with you, and Penelope Trickett attributes that to you and your involvement with these women.
Well, she's being very generous, first of all, but I think the credit goes to the women themselves, because what we really tried to do in this study was not make it about abuse, okay? We made it about their life stories, and we made it about their contribution to science. So every time we would meet, we would talk about that. And they were able to take tremendous pride in doing something sort of larger than themselves. You know, they'll call me, they'll say, "Miss Jenny, you know, I just graduated," or "I just got my kids back from protective services," or, "You know, I want to be a social worker now. What do you think?" And it's sort of a commitment to being able to tell their stories and make a difference. And they see that. And every time I interview them, and we just started our new round of interviews, we haven't seen them for about 7 or 8 years, so I'm seeing them again.
Oh my.
And they'll say, "Oh, I remember you, and you still have curly hair." Or I say, "Yeah, I remember you and your mom when you did these tasks together." And they'll say, "Yeah, what has that been like to see these lives change?" And it's an inspiration for them. And now their children are involved in the study. And we have about 450 kids. And they also see the importance of understanding sort of the intergenerational aspect of all of this. So it's a tremendous
yeah.
amount of pride.
And for you, this really humanizes it. This is
yeah.
no longer just a number, 1.2 million children in the U.S. who are
right.
victims of maltreatment.
Right. Sort of one thing it does is when I put all of my research together and all my quantification and all my questionnaires, and then I do the whole protocol, and the end of it, I feel sometimes like, I don't know if I captured it all. I don't know if her story really is captured here and is captured well enough. So sometimes I feel like I would like to write a book sometime, or like to tell the story from the real visceral level. And that's what these kinds of venues sort of allow us to do. Because I think there's a lot more to these lives that we're gonna learn about as these women are able to look back on their whole lives and tell us something about what made the difference, or what made it worse, or how did they get better, or what has the real struggle been that we haven't really seen so far.
Let's talk about some of the long-term consequences that you have found as a result of this study. They are enormous.
Yeah, well, we didn't really know much about health consequences when we started the study. I mean, I was looking at teen pregnancy, and I was looking at the things that were unique to sexual abuse in terms of female development. And we started noticing other things that were happening. Like, we started noticing how heavy these women were. And we started tracking their obesity rates. And we started listening to how they would talk about going to the emergency room a lot. And so we started tracking that. And we started looking at, like, their premature delivery rates. And we started really understanding that there are some health disparities that are directly attributable to abuse. Because, as you know, we've studied a group of non-abused women alongside these women, and the differences that we see, we can talk about as attributable to the abuse and the chronic adversity and the chronic stress, even different from women who grew up in the exact same neighborhoods.
With
yeah.
under the same economic
yes,
situations
exactly.
or also in a single parent family.
Right, exactly. And so what we're learning about is not just obesity rates, but, you know, things about inflammatory markers, and we're getting whole blood panels now, so we're going to learn about risk for diabetes and risk for cancers, so that we could maybe say what has been different about those women who develop them and those women who don't, and what kind of interventions might we try to design that could curtail some of these health disparities.
One of the members of your team who will be joining you in just a couple couple of months is actually studying telomeres, these biomarkers that are showing premature aging among people who suffered the kind of stress you suffer when you've been the victim of trauma.
Right. He's going to do some animal model research and so forth, and that's some basic science to help us connect some of these dots. Because what I see behaviorally in my study, I've also looked at their cognitive abilities, you know, how they take tests and how their memory is and those kinds of things. And we're starting to see what we think is premature cognitive aging in this group. And so this next round of funding is allowing me to collaborate with some researchers at Penn State who understand this in a fine-grained way so that I can start giving different kinds of tests that are going to give us the early clues of what we might be seeing in terms of premature cognitive aging.
You mentioned that this is really now becoming a multi-generational study, and so you're looking at the children of these women, many of whom had children as teenagers, five times greater rate than the general population. The surprising thing here to me is you would think that if someone were the victim of child sexual abuse that they would be hypervigilant as a parent, and it's actually the exact opposite.
That's a multifaceted problem as well, because initially people would assume that the abused became the abuser in some ways, and so we were looking for those sort of pathways we didn't see. But we see environments that are recreated, you know, for these women's children that were there when they were children. So it's not that they are abusing their kids themselves, it's that there might be substance abuse, there might be depression, there might be multiple sort of stepfathers and other men coming into the household. In some cases, the grandfather that was the original abuser has access to those kids still. So there are environments that are sort of allowed to persist, and moms may not be that adept at understanding when there is danger, or reading cues from the kid that says, hey mom, this guy's kind of creepy, or, you know, I need something you're not giving me.
The preference has been for decades that we want to keep biological families together. Do you think there's a chance that your research will change that thinking?
I don't think that that's sort of a thread that I want to weave in through this research, because you know, the foster care system is wonderful in a lot of ways, and it also has its own problems. They're really trying to understand how kinship care is effective for some families, but maybe not as effective for others, where there is this sort of environment that doesn't change as a result of keeping the kids within the kinship care. But I think more than that is teaching the mothers, the non-abusing caretaker that ends up with the child no matter what, how to effectively parent and how to effectively have relationships that don't endanger that environment any further. So it's not as simple as to say we should or should not keep the biological family together, but I think multiple systems need to understand just the wide variation that goes on in those families.
You have also studied internet use among maltreated girls. What are you finding there?
Yeah, so that's interesting. So when you have these long-term studies, one thing you have to do is find people, right? And when social networking started and I started to find people on Facebook and MySpace and all of those old things, I started noticing a little bit about how the women in my studies would present themselves online as more provocatively and a little bit more sort of risque than kids their age in different kinds of circumstances. So I thought to myself, what is it that predisposes someone who's had an abuse history to maybe present themselves in a way that might be, you know, attractive to a perpetrator who's maybe trolling the internet and looking for a vulnerable teen? So I started looking at this more in a very large sample at Children's Hospital, where we are tracking the internet use and social media behaviors of abused and non-abused teens to try to understand this propensity a little bit more and try to understand why it is that they go these routes.
Could it be in part because their value is all tied up in their sexuality? That's what they've been taught since a very young age.
Well, I think that there's likely multiple courses. But first of all, what we know about abused girls is that they have sex earlier. They are a bit more promiscuous. There is sort of an orientation towards sex and sort of a sexual identity earlier on. But we also know that they have a larger propensity to be re-victimized. So there are pathways there. Like, why is it that they are entertaining sexual advances from exploitive individuals when someone else may say no or stop or be bullied more? Or when they get older, there's a higher propensity of rape and domestic violence. So there's a propensity not just about being involved in sexual situations earlier, but the propensity for re-victimization.
And that early experience, that early violation, that set them up for all of this?
Well, if you sort of think about what happens to an abuse victim, and when they're young and their sexual boundary violations are so egregious at ages when they don't even understand what that is, and they become perhaps the object of sexual desire of someone who is a caretaker or someone who's supposed to be taking care of them, a lot of confusion can ensue around what is sex, what is intimacy, who am I as a sexual being? And when you then reach adolescence or late adolescence, when you have that own identity to discover and to form, it's very difficult to make that transition from what it was and it was unhealthy to what it might be in a more healthy way.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and our guest is Jenny Knoll, who directs Penn State's Network on Child Protection and Well-Being. She is an internationally recognized expert on child maltreatment, and her work focuses on the long-term consequences of childhood sexual abuse.
One of the most difficult things for victims is this question of why me? Right. If we're talking about Sandusky or if we're talking about the priest pedophile problem, You know, so many boys weren't chosen. And so that does leave a lot of people saying, why did they pick me? What was it about me that made someone think they could take advantage of me in that way?
Yeah, that's such an unfortunate place for a victim to be at, because one of the things that is so tragic is that there is sometimes guilt and self-blame that comes along with this, because it's something that no one can understand at that age. It's something so foreign to what the developmental experience should be. Sometimes there's violence involved, like, if you don't do this, I'm going to hurt you, or I'm going to hurt your mom, or I'm going to hurt your sister or something. So you sort of, victims stand in the way and say, yeah, you take me, don't take them, okay? And there's some kind of threat. That's a little bit, you know, almost easier sometimes in some circumstances, because it wasn't me, it was
you were protecting somebody.
But I worry more about the more classic incest victim, where it's perhaps a biological father, and she's groomed for a long time as if she were a romantic partner, and there's some relationship there that's under the auspices of love and all those things. That's, I think, a little bit harder for victims to overcome the guilt and shame about that. But what everybody needs to understand is no kid's responsible for this. And that's probably one of the biggest aspects of treatment, is to try to understand the sickness inherent in the perpetrator.
Speaking of the perpetrator, the real problem here is stopping the demand. Why are perpetrators interested in young girls or boys, and how do we stop that?
Yeah, right. Well, one of the beautiful things about this cluster hire is that we get to try to hire some experts who will help us understand that, because as a field, I don't think we understand that very well. Let's take Sandusky for an example. I mean, no one suspected him. He was very good at what he did. He groomed and kept things very, very secret, and he was good at making the boys not want to say anything or not say anything for years and years. So it's hard to spot something like that. But what we can learn is subtle ways that he was able to do this, and the ways that he took opportunities to be alone with boys. And this happens when we study perpetrators, you know, retrospectively, when they're caught and we say, okay, what happened? How did it work? It's much more difficult to create sort of a society where we're all out there looking for these people, because they work at this. And I think it's going to be more important for us as a society to know that if we suspect something or see something or feel weird about something, it's okay to tell someone or make the call and say, I think something weird's going on here, and some experts can help figure out whether there is something that's going on there.
The reality is that very, very few parents report when a child has been the victim of physical or sexual abuse. And even among physicians, primary care physicians, according to a survey, 27% of the times where they believe that some kind of abuse is taking place, they don't report it.
Right.
What keeps people from reporting?
First of all, people don't understand kind of what abuse is. And so to educate people about what it is and sort of the harmful effects of it will help motivate people to make those calls. But we have to also have the resources for people to make those calls. We have to have facilities there. We have to have phone numbers. We have to have people standing by that can say, yes, okay, I'll take it from here. Because the burden is placed on the professionals, not on the pediatricians who don't understand that process. But when there are no resources, people don't want to do it, or when people don't know about the resources, they won't do it as readily. So one of the things that we're trying to do is affect public policy by saying, look, if we know about it earlier, we can change the course of lives, but resources have to be funneled into those efforts, real resources. And in the state of Pennsylvania, those resources are beginning
to
flow. We have a long way to go.
You say that abused and maltreated children are drastically underserved nationwide. Yeah. And that brings me to the Great Recession, which we just experienced.
Right.
And there were reports that came out saying, look, we went through this terrible economic time and the rate of child abuse and maltreatment went down.
Right.
Some entrepreneurial Harvard-educated economist took another look, but he instead looked at what was happening on Google. His conclusion was that there was a correlation between unemployment rates. As they rose, so did Google searches on child abuse and child neglect and why does my dad hit me? Mm. He said that really came down to a lack of resources in times of economic stress.
Right. When we look at rates of child abuse, and those are reported nationally, those are about substantiated cases that actually go through the system and are successfully prosecuted and so forth. And that's an expensive process too, and that's a process that has to start with people actually making the call and there being resources in the county where that call is made. So it's really hard to pin down the exact rate of child abuse in this country, because what we know from adult retrospective reports is that a lot of people never have told anybody about it.
Should it be a red flag if you see on your child's Facebook page very promiscuous pictures, or as a teacher, if you see that, is that a red flag that something inappropriate may be going on in that home?
Well, I think I would probably start with why the judgment is not so good with that kid. And I might say, hey, do you know that by doing this, other people can see this? And it's just try to get a job and have a Facebook page like that. Try to get a babysitting gig and have someone see that. That's going to keep you from going ahead in life. And I think that kids don't really understand those implications as teenagers. But if that kind of behavior persists, and if there's an insistence, no, this is who I am, and this is what I do, and this is how I'm going to get attention, I think that warrants a deeper conversation about what might be going on with that kid or in that family that might warrant some talking to the parents or understanding the history a little bit.
Getting back to your study for a moment, of the 250 women who you followed for this 25 years now, what percentage of them are coping well, and do you have any idea why? What factors influence the fact that they're okay?
Right. Now, it depends on what you mean by well, because there's so many things to focus on. I mean, I'm amazed at the large propensity of them who don't have occupations or on SSI, you know, or living back at home with their mothers, just haven't been able to make that leap to adulthood, even in their 30s. And what I'm trying to do this time is really have them tell me what has made the difference in their lives. And I'm struck by those who've talked about, the ones who seem to be doing better, have talked about sort of second chance opportunities in their lives. One woman told me that, you know, she finally found a safe relationship to be in. So a partner who really was mature and secure and all of those kinds of things that could help her transcend some of the relationship problems she has had. Others just seem to be kind of tough, you know? Like, things roll off them. They learn to work hard as a young kid because they weren't with their families or they were in foster care or whatever. They had to really fend for themselves, and that's translated into really being able to do that as an adult. So there's just some resilient qualities that I don't think we understand very well that I'm hoping this study will help us illuminate so that we can maybe translate that into how to educate younger victims about how to help themselves a little bit.
Going forward, what are your research priorities here at Penn State?
Well, the first priority is to get the right faculty here to fill in the gaps in our field. We want to understand how to do more universal prevention better. We want to understand how to educate communities about what is child abuse and how to report it and how to make a difference in these families before it happens. So that's a hole in our field that we want to fill. And Penn State has fantastic researchers who've been doing this in a lot of other areas for many, many years. So we're going to learn from them. I also want to understand what kind of treatments we can augment with sexual abuse specific modules. So say there's a treatment out there for substance abuse or something, and why is it not as effective for victims of abuse? How can we augment those treatments? And then what kind of coordinated care can we provide for kids who are in protective services? Not just effective mental health treatment, which there are several mental health treatments that we should be promoting more thoroughly, but coordinated physical health care. Coordinated, watching kids go through adolescence and what kind of struggles they're having, and having some sort of revisiting of a coordinated care throughout their adolescence and early adulthood.
When we talk about all of the health consequences, everything from poor verbal ability and learning deficits to delinquency, depression, obesity, you name it, it mm-hmm. seems like an almost endless list. What it says to me is this is a problem that we should all care about.
Right. What I'm trying to do at the policy level, at the state level, is make legislatures understand that to spend some money early could save money later. So if kids who are coming through child abuse centers and advocacy centers could be paired with some good mental health providers and some coordinated care partners that focus on physical health and the family needs, we could likely impact a host of public health issues.
Prevent pregnancy, prevent incarceration.
And substance abuse, those kinds of things that we see manifesting later in life. So if you want to pick a high-risk group that's already identified for whom we are all mandated reporters, I think that's a big bang for our prevention buck. So that's sort of the ambassadorship part of my new job, is to help raise awareness that will hopefully facilitate some of this investment in these kids' lives as opposed to letting them affect the system later.
How right? optimistic are you that we can really make a dent in this 1.2 million children, and probably many
right,
more,
right.
who are the victims of child maltreatment?
Well, I'm quite optimistic now because I see the public awareness about the problem, and I see the significant investment that places like Penn State are putting into the problem. And as long as we can sustain this commitment, then I'm quite optimistic. And I see multiple fields at once advancing because we learn something about child abuse. If we can learn something about child abuse, we could learn something about obesity. We could learn something about pregnancy prevention. We can advance multiple fields at once. So that makes me excited, and that gives me hope. And I do think that in generations to come, we will be able to talk about child abuse more freely, and we will be able to spot it more readily, and we will be able to treat it more effectively. And that makes me happy.
All right, Jenny Knoll, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Patty. It's been great.
That was Dr. Jenny Knoll, director of Penn State's Network on Child Protection and Well-Being. To learn more about the network, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.